treating me right. Radioactive Mama, we'll reach critical mass tonight.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Sheldon Allman and Radioactive Mama from the atomic pop culture that grew alongside the dropping and testing of atomic bombs during the 1950s and 60s. We'll hear a few more cuts of music from this era during today's show, speaking with M.T. Sylvia, producer and director of the 80-minute film Atomic Mom that debuted October 2010. The film unfolds the story of M.T. Sylvia learning about the work of her mother, Pauline Sylvia, as a Navy biologist. Pauline Sylvia carried out research on the effects of radiation on mice and dogs at Hunter's Point in San Francisco. Pauline Sylvia was present also at the test sites in Nevada, and for years she never spoke with anyone about her work. This was standard practice with the military, and she had also been sworn to secrecy. But M.T. Sylvia, her daughter, was curious, and over time turned what had started off as recording a family history into this film. Atomic Mom includes travel to Hiroshima and interviews with Hibakusha, that's Japanese survivors of the blast in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and also the pop culture surrounding the atomic age in Las Vegas, and her mother's journey into the past and her ongoing question about why, when the military knew how radiation affected human beings, it exposed military personnel to test blasts anyway. I talked to M.T. Sylvia at her home in Oakland, California.
As a kid, I knew that she had worked, quote, on the atom bomb, but I didn't know what it meant. And as a child, I thought she was some sort of spy or James Bond movie type of character, because she couldn't talk about it. She was sworn to secrecy. And I fantasized about what it was, but I really had no idea what the atom bomb was. Later on in my life, I became an anti-war activist in my teens and early 20s, and I started working with the anti-nuclear movement and realizing, hey, what did my mom do? I knew she did something and we'd never really talked about it. But she came to visit me in San Francisco about 10 or 12 years ago, and we were driving north on 101, and when you look to the right of Candlestick Park, there is this tall white building with no windows in it. It's about 5 stories tall, and she said, oh, there's the Rad Lab. And I said, what? She said, that's the Naval Radiological Defense Laboratory. That's where I worked. And I just immediately started asking her all these questions, and that's how this whole story started.
As a quick aside, Hunter's Point that M.T. Sylvia refers to is a Hunter's Point naval shipyard, notorious in the San Francisco Bay Area for dumping radioactive waste in barrels off our coast and even scuttling a radioactive ship into the Pacific. Today, Hunter's Point is a series of highly toxic Superfund sites where Lennar Corporation, a development corporation, plans to build residential housing. Meanwhile, the current residents of the low-income, ethnically diverse communities around Hunter's Point suffer physical ailments from asthma to cancers. And these residents are prohibited from eating any of the vegetables that they may grow in their small gardens. Let's turn again to M.T. Sylvia and when her mother began opening up about her work.
Later, I found out during her spiritual journey in the mid-90s is when she started looking back on her life and all the things that she had done, and she started really looking at this time in the military. She worked on this program for about 4 years. I'm really proud of her that she did. In this age of WikiLeaks and, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, I think it's really important that people tell the truth about their experience and so people get real information.
She is very honest about it.
Yeah, it's a struggle for her. She made an oath and a promise that she wouldn't tell these secrets. Mm-hmm. And in the 50s, that was a really big deal. So it's been a lifelong process for her to give herself permission to talk about it.
That point where she talks with, is it Ray Harbert, mm-hmm. in the movie?
Mm-hmm.
Where you can see she's really feeling like it's okay to relax and talk to this man.
They have found a kindred spirit together because Ray had worked in the Bikini Islands and had strong feelings about what happened to the people on the island of Rongelap, which my mother did as well, because they would ship animals from Rongelap to San Francisco, Hunter's Point, and she would study the radiation effects. Mm-hmm. And so they really bonded on that, and they both felt the same about the Atomic Testing Museum in Las Vegas, about how it really falls short on showing anything about the humanity and it's so focused on the technology.
she was in an interesting situation in the 50s, right? Women didn't really get these kinds of jobs. And she talks in the movie about how she had to compartmentalize her brain.
Yeah, it was part of being in the military. And you know, she even talks about this in the film, where different branches of the military weren't talking to each other. So she was in the Navy while, you know, the Air Force was doing their own experiments, the Army was doing their own experiments, and nobody was really talking to each other, mm-hmm. which is why she was so confused that when they started putting soldiers in trenches out in the desert, you know, certain distances from ground zero, and detonating the bombs. Because it was, you know, all the research she was doing was showing about the effects of ionizing radiation and, you know, what radiation illness was, and she was doing this with animals, and at the same time, they were putting humans out there, soldiers in the trenches.
I asked M.T. Sylvia to describe her own process of discovery as the story unfolded.
You know, I really wanted to understand this part of my mother's life, and I, you know, I had a real conflict about it. We were both on different pages around it, and I mean, she was very proud of her military service and what she did for this country, and I can appreciate that, and I have a respect for that. But I was also in a big conflict because I was so anti-war, and to think about her working on the development of the atom bombs. Now, she didn't specifically do that. She studied the effects of radiation from them, but it was a real conflict for me. So I just started asking her all these questions. I just let myself be open to hearing what she had to say. She came to visit me, and she brought a box of all of her Navy files, and we started going through it together, and I asked her if I could turn on a camera and film it, because it was just such an interesting story. And I just wanted to record it for family history. That was my simple intention. I had no intention of making a documentary at that point. I just wanted to get it down on tape. Just want to miss any of it. And so I was really grateful that she let me do that, and it was here at this kitchen table, or dining room table, was the first time we did that. So I just kept asking her questions, and she was really honest with me. And then she went home back to Rhode Island, and I kept doing all this research on the Nevada test site, on the atomic testing program, on radiation survivors, on Hunter's Point. I actually went to Las Vegas for my job twice, and on one of those trips I took a tour of the Nevada test site, and I just really wanted to experience what she experienced and understand it. And during that trip, I called her and told her what I was doing and sent her all this information. I found 3 scientific papers that she had co-authored. And then I invited her to take the trip with me, and she wanted to go back to the test site herself. And I think it was part of her trying to find some resolution in her own heart and mind about the work that she had done. And so we did the trip together, and I wasn't allowed to take a camera with me, but it was a very emotional experience, and it was a very sacred kind of thing to experience with her. I went back to Las Vegas again, and they had opened this new museum of atomic testing, and I had really strong feelings about it because it was so technical, and there was very little about the humanity and what happens to people and living things with this technology. And while I was there, I met this woman who knew about an oral history project at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And the test site workers, and a woman named Mary Pileski was doing it, and she gave me her card. And I emailed Mary, and Mary had done over 150 oral histories but had never talked to a woman scientist. And so she was very interested in talking with my mom. And so I talked my mom into coming back to Las Vegas one more time to do this oral history. And I told her I'd like to hire a professional film crew for this and really film it and have Mary interview my mother so that there'd be some distance between me and my mom. And so I hired 2 friends of mine, a camera person and a sound person, and we went to Las Vegas for a week. And that's where we met Ray Harbert and Sister Rosemary Lynch from Pachi Bene. And my mom got to talk to all these people for a week. And by the time she left, I think she was lighter and felt better about it.
M.T. Sylvia traveled to Hiroshima, and the film shows amazing and very troubling footage of the aftermath of dropping the bomb on that city.
My day job was going to send me to Japan, and I thought, well, I should go to the Hiroshima Peace Museum, and I wanted to go to Hiroshima. I was really motivated to go. works. And I emailed the museum and asked if I could have permission to film inside the museum. And they put me in touch with Tomoko Nishisaki from the Hiroshima Film Commission. And she got me carte blanche to film anywhere in the city of Hiroshima, in the Peace Park, the train station. All the location fees were waived. She asked me if I wanted to interview Dr. Shintaro Hida, who at the time was in his early 90s, and he actually took the train from Tokyo to Hiroshima, which is about a 3.5-hour train ride, just to do this interview with me. And so she arranged all of that. I interviewed the director of the museum. She asked me if I wanted to interview a survivor, and I hadn't thought about that. I said, well, yeah, maybe. And she said, well, what kind of survivor do you want to interview? And I thought, wow, what a weird question. It just made me really uncomfortable. Because I felt like I was shopping for a Hiroshima survivor. It felt really weird to me. I had a bunch of my journalist friends come over for dinner to teach me how to interview, because I had never interviewed before. And one of them suggested, why don't you try to find a mother with a daughter and make a parallel between you and your mom? And I thought, what a great idea. And so I emailed Tomoko, and so she found me Miss Okada and her daughter. And so by the time I got to Hiroshima, I had 3 days of shooting all lined up with all these interviews. And you know, it just snowballed and evolved kind of organically. So the whole story went in a completely different direction.
What's touching in the movie also is Miss Okada, who also says that she never really talked about her feelings about it. She always talked about it as a peace campaign or as an anti-nuclear campaign.
Yeah, and her daughter had never spoken about it for many years, and there was such a parallel between my mom and I. And when I interviewed them together, I asked them, you know, have you talked about it over all the years? And Miss Okada looked at her daughter and said, I don't think we've ever talked about it. I know that it started a dialogue for them, just being part of this film and talking about it.
Which is what I think the film is going to do overall.
Mm-hmm.
Especially now with the catastrophe in Japan, all of this is up again.
Yeah, it's really timely. I mean, the fact is we're all downwind of this story, and we have been for many, many years. And we continue to be.
Yeah, and we act again as if that's really not the case. We're going to continue to build nuclear power plants because we need the power.
Mm-hmm. We continue to put ourselves at risk.
Yes, we continue to put ourselves at risk, and much of the time we barely know it because the information we need is sketchy at best. Before we take a closer look at that, a reminder that you're listening to Raising Sand Radio, and I'm Susan Gallimore, talking with M.T. Sylvia, the producer and director, about her film Atomic Mom. Go to RaisingSandRadio.org to listen to other shows we have aired on this topic, from the Hunter's Point community, as I mentioned earlier, to interviews with Hibakusha Takashi Tanimori-san and others telling their stories. Here's a clip from the 10-minute trailer with Pauline Sylvia talking about her work. You can view this trailer, go to AtomicMom.org, and you can watch it there.
We would put the mice into these huge lead spheres at different areas around ground zero. And we would sit up all night until daybreak. That would be the time for the detonation. And we sat there on the hill and would link arms. We're told to put our heads down and not to look up. I thought, isn't this a hotshot thing? Am I going to have stories to tell about the fact that I saw an atomic detonation? How many people in the world see atomic detonations and have lived to tell it? I mean, that's what was going through my head. That's where my head was at that point.
But thinking about it today?
I should have been thinking about a lot of other things. I remember this sign that was going to be outside my office. The sign said, Thermal Injury Branch.
That took us into a new project. And for that, we used dogs. We literally burned these dogs right down to the skin. And I began to think about all of those things.
Meanwhile, 100 miles away in Las Vegas, people were not thinking at all. Americans were, in fact, generating a lot of excitement about atomic power in Las Vegas during the 50s and 60s. Those running the test sites worked together with those in the growing tourist and gambling industries in Las Vegas, and tourists were able to party all night and then go and sit outside and watch these bombs detonate. The music we opened with, Radioactive Mama, and the film Atomic Mom, allude to beauty pageants, atomic bomb hairstyles, and other celebrations of the atomic age. Here are a couple of snippets from music of that time. We'll listen to Sheldon Allman again, and this time with Crawl Out Through the Fallout.
Crawl out through the fallout, baby, when they drop that bomb. Crawl out through the fallout with the greatest of aplomb. When your white count's getting higher, hurry, don't delay. I'll hold you close and kiss those radiation burns away. Crawl
out through the... And another clip with Elton Britt called Uranium Fever. This one was from 1955.
I don't know, but I've been told uranium ore is worth more than gold. Sold my cad, I bought me a Jeep. I got that bug and I can't sleep.
Uranium fever has come and got me down. Uranium fever is spreading all around.
With a Geiger counter in my hand,
I'm going out to stake me some government land.
Uranium fever has come and got me down.
Atomic Mom shows footage that many of us have never seen before, including American propaganda of the time, and then, as I mentioned earlier, stunningly painful footage from Japan.
I had found a photograph of Miss Atomic Bomb from a beauty pageant from 1957, and I wanted to get the rights to use that image in the film. So I went to the Las Vegas News Bureau, and there was this kid at the counter, and I said, "Do you have any moving footage of, you know, any film footage or anything?" And he said, "Oh yeah, come on in the back, I'll show you this tape." And he took me back and showed me the atomic hairdo, which he saw from the Flamingo Hotel. Women used to wear their hair shaped as mushroom clouds. And he showed me the footage of the marquee of Welcome Atomic Soldiers, and I said, "Oh, I have to have this." And I requested permission, and they denied me. They said they didn't want Las Vegas to be seen in a negative light.
This was congruent with not wanting atomic bombs to be seen in a negative light either. A press code, for example, had been in effect on what the public was allowed to know about the effects of the bombings in Japan.
So the press code started directly after the bombings and wasn't lifted until 1952. So there were years of censorship. And what a lot of people don't realize and what comes out in the film is that the people in Japan were censored as well by the Japanese government as well. And where Dr. Heater couldn't talk to other doctors about radiation illness, and they couldn't report on their treatments they were doing at conferences, and it was really suppressed, all the information.
And yet they were seeing, at one point in the movie, he's talking about seeing up to 10,000 people a day, well, lined up for mm-hmm. care, and they had absolutely no idea what to do with these people.
Right, and they had no idea what they were treating. They didn't know what radiation illness was. And at first they thought they had an infection and that everyone was getting infected, which is why all these people were dying afterwards, especially people who weren't present at the bombing but came in immediately after to look for their loved ones and died 2 weeks later, you know, because of all the high levels of radiation. They thought they had an infection. And they were just desperate and helpless trying to figure out what to do. Even for years later, we're not allowed to report on any of their findings or talk to their colleagues about it.
And it actually has been very effective because, as we were talking about earlier, this kind of research, a lot of us just don't know about it.
Mm-hmm.
And we know something when we think we know more than we actually do know,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, and the parallels today with what's happening in Japan, it's so timely. There's so much chaos around the information we're getting, and so much of it I don't trust, and even my friends in Hiroshima don't trust, or my friends in Japan. they're getting their information from places outside of Japan about what's happening. And I got an email from a friend in Hiroshima who said that she quoted the radiation weather forecast, which they were doing daily on the weather report, the radiation weather forecast. And I thought, oh my God, this is going to become a household word now. This is going to be common every night, like the smog alert. And Hiroshima was expecting the contamination to reach them in like in the next day or two. And when you think about the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, who were mostly children and young adults when all of that happened, that are alive today, and here in the second time in a lifetime, they have to see such a catastrophic disaster and experience it again in their twilight years. It just breaks my heart.
MT and her mother, Pauline Sylvia, still have a few differences. One of them is about Pauline Sylvia's health.
She doesn't want me to talk about what her specific health issues are, and I respect that, but this is where we're on a different page. You know, she doesn't think any of her illnesses are related to her exposure, and I find that hard to believe. And it's really hard to prove it, too.
Ray Harbert talks about the Marshall Islands and one of the bombings of Bikini that he witnessed, and that's when he thinks he got his skin cancer.
Yeah, and actually Ray passed away from bladder cancer, and it was about a year and a half after, 2 years after we filmed him in the movie. He thought his bladder cancer was directly related to his... I mean, he had been battling skin cancer for a long time, mm-hmm. but the bladder cancer came up pretty quickly, and that's very common in atomic vets. And the thing that's my mother really struggled with was, what did they do with all of her research, and why did she do the research when they already knew it about Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Why did they have to do it again? And then, knowing what we knew, why did they put all these soldiers out in the trenches at the test site? And why did we expose, you know, most of the United States to this radioactive fallout in the name of science? And I think it's why she participated in the movie, because she wanted people to know about what happened.
And what do you make of those questions? Why did they?
You know, when they first did the first bomb at Trinity in Los Alamos, they didn't know if the universe was going to catch on fire. And they still detonated that bomb. And that boggles my mind. It's like, why would you take that kind of a risk just so you could know something, just so you could prove something scientifically? And, you know, at the time, there was so much anti-Japanese racism that was developed and enhanced just to justify dropping these bombs. They never would have dropped them in Germany. You know, and all that racism was really vital to them dropping these bombs. You know, it cost them billions of dollars to make these bombs, and they had, you know, the war was basically over, so Japan was losing, but they went ahead and to test them because they wanted to have this kind of power and might in the future. And the two bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, one was a plutonium bomb and one was a uranium bomb. So there are people who might argue that the bomb in Hiroshima could be justified, but you cannot justify the bomb in Nagasaki. It was purely testing a different kind of technology. And most of the testing has been done on indigenous people's land. The Nevada test site is on Shoshone land. The Marshall Islanders, the native people in the Marshall Islanders, and the aboriginals in Australia, you have to know about that as well, that these test sites were on people's lands, the indigenous people's lands, which is still horrific as well.
When you look at the footage of the desert in Nevada where the tests were carried out, can that land be turned back safely to people anyway?
No. I think some of the parts of the test site are still hot, and there's like football fields full of contaminated waste that's being stored there. The Marshall Islands, the people on Ranjalab, they were sent back to their island in the early 80s, and it was still hot, and Greenpeace came in 1985 and evacuated them again. But they've been put back there again to the island. They can't eat any of the vegetables on the island, and so they can only eat processed food that's brought in. So, I mean, it's completely destroyed their culture.
And again, Ray Harbert makes reference to concreting over one of the islands.
Yeah, Anahuac, they just cover it in cement.
Which is kind of what they do here with the bases. I mean, we're talking about putting a cap on Alameda because it's so radioactive. Mm-hmm. They do it at Hunter's Point. It's like cover it up, put a bit of sand on top, off you go.
Compartmentalize it.
wait a little while and then put a bunch of people on there to live on it because they won't actually know what happened.
Right, right. Yeah, I had a friend who was an acupuncturist on Hunter's Point in a clinic over there, and she saw so many high incidences of asthma, breast cancer, all kinds of cancers, you know, all kinds of symptoms.
How does M.T. Sylvia, producer and director of Atomic Mom, hope this movie makes a difference in our world?
Well, I think it's timely now because people feel at risk right now because of what's happened in Japan. And so I think people are wanting to know more about it and seeking out the information. And this is what Atomic Mom is for me. It's a prayer for a softer world. And for me, it started at the kitchen table with my mom just asking questions. And I think that's where we all have to start, is just to at least start talking about it instead of not talking about it and asking questions. And then once we know the answers to those questions, ask what the knowing asks of us. You know, I mean, we can't just sit by, and it's the apathy that keeps it going. The fact that we're still on hair trigger alert with thousands of nuclear weapons, 100 times bigger than Hiroshima and Nagasaki, pointed at each other right now is way more of an emergency than global warming, because in a matter of moments we can destroy the entire planet. And a lot of people don't realize we're still on hair trigger alert. They think the Cold War ended and that was over. And I think that's where we have to start, is to modify the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review, not just to reduce nuclear weapons, but to completely abolish them.
But we're not going to be doing that. Obama, in fact, just decided to replenish our arsenals.
Yeah, and the Hibakusha, the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, are so upset with him after his speech in Prague. It's shameful after what he said in Prague and what he promised them, and now we've turned around and doing something completely different. And they are outraged at him, and I am too.
Here's a clip of what Obama said in Prague.
As the only nuclear power to have used a nuclear weapon, the United States has a moral responsibility to act. We cannot succeed in this endeavor alone, but we can lead it. We can start it. So today, I state clearly and with conviction America's commitment to seek the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons.
That was President Obama in Prague in April 2009. Less than a year later, he budgeted over $80 million to replenish and renew our nuclear arsenal. So Raising Sand Radio is going to stay on top of the story and bring you this sort of news, because it's not the kind of thing that we can continue to ignore, as we have done for the last 50 or 60 years. What can you do? First, thank you to M.T. Sylvia for the documentary Atomic Mom. And go there to the website atomicmom.org to find out where you can watch this film and begin to learn as much as you can about this topic. Atomic Mom has won several awards, including the Gold Award for Best Feature Documentary, and that's at the Lake Arrowhead Film Festival, the Best Feature Documentary Jury Award at the 2011 Thin Line Film Festival, and the Silver Palm Award at the Mexico International Film Festival. Visit the website atomicmom.org to view the trailer or to find out where you can see the show, or if you want to contact producer and director M.T. Sylvia directly yourself. And that is our show for this week. Visit our website for links mentioned in this show or to download other shows we have aired on this topic. Again, that's raisingsandradio.org, and you can also contact me directly at susan@raisingsandradio.org. Let's go out with a compilation of music that captures how our culture presented one of the most tragic inventions of our time.
Well, I'm going to preach all a sermon about old man Adam, and I don't mean the Adam in the Bible, Adam. No, I don't mean the Adam that Mother Eve made it. I mean the thing that science liberated. The thing that Einstein says he's scared of, and when Einstein's scared, brother, I'm scared.
I've been to Nagasaki, Hiroshima too.